Have another meeting. How long are you going?
Well, we have two witnesses on the other bill, and we'll probably get to you in about 15 minutes.
2494.
Or I can hold it over to the others first.
Yeah, maybe you hold them over, and I'll get back as soon as I can.
So okay. Where are you going to be? Are you just to find you somewhere?
My office.
Do you have the bill file?
Okay.
Okay. All right.
Ready? All right. House Committee on Revenue for April 8th, 2015 will come to order. Colleagues, we've been discussing when to do which bill in order to get our agenda dealt with today, and we're going to start with the public hearing on House Bill 2494 that we held over from yesterday. Paul, do you want to tell us about that bill?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2494 directs the Legislative Revenue Officer, that's me in the office, to prepare an economic impact statement for bills before legislative committees under certain conditions. And the condition is that at least two committee members, one from each political party, must agree to make the request valid. So the this would be a new direction in terms of the responsibilities of the office to prepare economic impact statements. We do have a fair amount of economic modeling capability, as you would suspect, and I have on the background of your SMS just kind of the three major models that we maintain at this time. The first is the M-Plan model, which is an economic impact model. It's used by a number of the departments. Department of Forestry, for example, uses it, Department of Transportation, and we use it for short-term impacts when we have a shock to the system, either positive or negative. We also have a contract with Regional Economic Modeling Incorporated, which is the REMI model. They produce a model for each state, and we have the Oregon model, and we can use that for longer-term analysis. It's tied to the REMI National Forecast. And so we can build in changes in major policy tools or changes in the economic environment, shocks to the system, and analyze the employment impacts as well as other economic impacts. The third model we have, we developed on our own in 2001, the Oregon Tax Incidence Model, the OTIM model, I think most of you are familiar with. That model has recently been updated. I spent some time in the interim and updated the database in it and reconfigured a number of the equations in that model. That's primarily a long-term model, and it's really designed to look at major tax changes in the system, and that gives you both an impact on the distribution of the tax burden and also employment and other economic variables.
Great. And we have an august panel in front of us. Please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm State Representative John Davis here to testify in favor of House Bill 2494. It's my pleasure to bring this bill before you. However, it is even a greater pleasure to have hosted my trusty sidekick here, Brianna Wellman, who is a third-year law student at Willamette Law School. I have had the pleasure of her in my office full-time all semester as an extern through Willamette Law's externship program, and I have devised this today as her capstone for her service in my office to present to you House Bill 2494, and she's expecting a thorough grilling, not unlike mock trial that she may experience, and I'll be here to help with any technical questions.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and then give your testimony.
Sure. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Brianna Wellman, and I'm a legal extern for Representative Davis. He asked that I testify today to share some of my research regarding House Bill 2494. And all of my research has been uploaded into the meeting materials for today, should you want to go back and reference it later or try to follow along with me during my testimony today. So first, I'll start with a brief explanation of House Bill 2494. The bill would require the Legislative Revenue Officer to prepare an economic impact statement for a bill scheduled for a public hearing or a work session if requested by at least two members of the committee, including at least one from each major political party. The statement would describe the effect the bill would have on Oregon's economy. And at this time, the bill does not describe particular issues or factors that have to be considered when preparing the statement. So many states have enacted similar pieces of legislation or legislative rules requiring economic impact statements to be prepared under certain circumstances. I will go ahead and run through a few state statutes, which will highlight some of the differences between Oregon's proposed legislation and legislation that's already been enacted in other states. So first I'll start with New Jersey. So New Jersey statute is very similar to House Bill 2494. In New Jersey, an economic impact statement is prepared by the Commissioner of Commerce and Economic Development when a majority of the legislative committee requests that it be prepared. The committee then specifies the areas of impact that should be covered by the statement. The statement also must include a jobs impact statement, and then the statute lists the number of items that must be included within the jobs impact statement. In Maryland, an economic impact analysis is performed under two circumstances. First, it's prepared by the appropriate agency for each bill introduced at the request of the administration, department, agency, or commission of the executive branch. Second, one's prepared by the Department of Legislative Services for each bill introduced by a member of the Legislative Assembly. The economic impact analysis must include estimates relating to a list of six factors. Some of these factors are the cost of providing goods and services, the effect on the workforce, and the efficiency in production and marketing. In Texas, an economic impact statement shall be prepared at the request of the Lieutenant Governor or the Speaker of the House by a state agency for any pending bill that directly affects that agency. Texas's statute also provides a list of items that must be included within the statement, and that list is very similar to the list that appears in Maryland's statute. So in sum, states have passed similar legislation to House Bill 2494. Some of the key differences between other state legislation and House Bill 2494 are, one, the agency or body that's required to prepare the statement, two, the circumstances under which one must be prepared, and three, the factors or issues that have to be considered when preparing the statement. I should also note that some states, such as Florida and Louisiana, have enacted House rules rather than statutes requiring economic impact statements to be prepared in certain circumstances. And other states, including Hawaii, Montana, Virginia, and Washington, require an economic impact statement to be prepared for proposed agency regulations. So as you can see, economic impact statements are required to be prepared in many states, whether through legislation or through legislative rule. And House Bill 2494 certainly wouldn't be the first bill of its kind or statute of its kind. Thanks for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I will be happy to attempt to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill. Having worked with our fine staff of economists for eight long years, realizing how much they have to do and how much is on their plate, one worries about overwhelming them with this additional work that would go with something like this. These other states have added folks to help do all this work. How do we know how much more we're adding to their job?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, I am not sure how much more staff they had to add in order to implement this program that they'd passed, but I'd be happy to try to check into that and get back to you.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Davis.
In response to that, Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, we did ask that a preliminary fiscal be prepared by Dr. Warner, and I believe he shared some information a month or two ago, and maybe he'd be willing to share that same information to the committee about what the cost might be.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, in terms of the type of analysis, I think it's something that is a pointed out the models that we have here is something that we have the capacity to do. I think some of it would depend on the specifics that you would put into the specific requirements, specific information that you would require. But I think in terms of our capacity, I think we have some. I've suggested perhaps some additional software in my response to Representative Davis. But the fiscal impact overall would not be large. I think you did put the concern, I guess, we would have would be what I call a peak load problem, that when we tend to, and of course in the legislative session, we tend to get a lot of requests at the same time. I think it's certainly something we're capable of doing, as long as we could kind of space it out and get enough forewarning as to when it would be required.
And I did notice that it was for both those public hearings and work sessions, so I was a little surprised at seeing that it expanded to those that were just going to perhaps get a public hearing. Did you consider perhaps narrowing it to just those that were going to be worked?
Did you? Chair Barnhart and Representative Bentz, I think that's a welcome suggestion, since we only require fiscals and revenue impact statements at a work session. I think it would be a good idea maybe to limit economic impact statements to the same.
And then a final question. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And this is not intended too much as a comment on our fabulous team of economists, but they are economists. And so the question becomes the value of that which they provide us with. Had you considered the possibility that perhaps the economic impact statement would be just pleasant reading and not necessarily that helpful?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Spence. That's a good question. I would say, I mean, I don't know if I could answer that question.
Right. Do you have information from other states that might help answer that question?
No,
in terms
I
of whether
not.
They found that to be helpful or not?
No, I do not.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, I do find interesting, in the record, there should be the Washington statute that requires an economic impact statement
there is.
For agency rules, and it does provide some guidance as to what that statement should be aimed at providing. And I think it's helpful to look at that statute. I know it was in the meeting materials from yesterday, and hopefully it also got bumped into today's meeting materials. But as Brianna testified, other statutes do get more specific than what this bill provides, and it could be helpful so that committee members and the public know what the purpose of the statement is, what it's actually attempting to inform us of.
Thank you.
There it is, right at the bottom.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say, first of all, Brianna, what a great idea for a project. So thank you for being here and for doing this. I think it's a great idea. As to my question, so in the research that you did, you mentioned that a lot of states had specific things to look for. Would you, from that research, have any suggestions to this committee of what kind of elements that you saw, either whether it was because it seemed like a good idea to you or maybe it's something that occurred in a lot of the different state statutes? Do you have any suggestions for this committee about what might be included in such a report?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith-Warner. There's a couple state statutes, Maryland and I believe it's Texas, yes. They both are more specific, requiring certain items be included in their statements. Mm-hmm. For instance, I think Maryland's list is pretty good. Maryland has a list of 6 factors that at least need to be considered. They aren't required to be in the actual impact statement, but they need to be considered. And these factors are the cost of providing goods and services, the effect on the workforce, the effect on the cost of housing, the efficiency in production and marketing, capital investment, taxation, competition, and economic development, and consumer choice. So I think if the bill were to be more specific, perhaps considering some of those factors would be a good idea.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Vega Peterson, please.
So my question was going to be similar to Representative Smith-Warner's, but I was just, you know, in considering the criteria to use in terms of when we need to have this bill, I'm just curious, looking at how it is with 2 members of the committee, one from either party, versus some of the other states and have different means of doing it, some even around, you know, potential impacts on businesses that require economic interest. So I'm curious about the process of getting to this method.
You came up.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Representative Vice Chair Vega Peterson, that's a great question. I will blame the method on Representative Clem. Mm-hmm. This bill has been introduced in similar forms in many legislative sessions. And when I said, hey, would you be interested in co-sponsoring this, he said, well, what about the idea of requiring at least one member from each major party to sign on to it? And the point I think is a good suggestion is twofold. One is to reduce volume, that it won't be required in every single bill of the many thousands that we consider, and also that it will be considered in instances where it's not simply a partisan ploy to either kill a bill or to move it forward, that there's genuine interest from both sides of the aisle in understanding the impact of the legislation.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt?
Well, first I have a question for Dr. Warner. That's sort of half of this. What economic model does our state economist use? And could you describe the process that Oregon goes through to derive our economic forecast?
Okay. Representative Whitsitt, our state economist uses basically the same approach that all the states do. It's what I call a bootstrap model. It's a set of equations linking Oregon's economy to a national forecast. So, and they get a national forecast from a forecast service, and most all the states do that. So you get a consistent national forecast, and then you have equations that can link the sectors of the Oregon economy to that national forecast. So they're continually updating that. Of course, it focuses on the short term, on the business cycle. They're getting new information on a regular basis. So it's designed to forecast movements in the state economy and therefore in tax revenue. It's not a long-term model in the sense that it looks at how structural changes, how changes in policy may affect the state economy. The models that I referred to that we have in Legislative Revenue Office are more of that structural kind. So we can say, all right, let's say if we eliminated the corporate income tax and replaced it with some other tax, how would that affect employment, migration, and income in the Oregon economy? So that's much more of a long-term model and not really a forecasting model.
And I just have a follow-up.
Please, yes.
Maybe a great place to start would be with ways and means and revenue bills for your bill. You know, that would be, you might start off with something that's that specific to this building and those committees.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you so much. This very helpful. Did she pass?
Okay. She's going to graduate law school.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Leininger.
I just wanted to congratulate you on an excellent presentation and a great working rapport that you have. And, you know, we as representatives are by far strongest when we help colleagues of ours incubate and develop great ideas that they have. And to see you two doing that, I think, is a real testament to both of you. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kluding. You're up.
I didn't think I'd signed up for that tonight.
All right. Thank you. Anyone else want to be heard on House Bill 2494? Without anyone else arriving, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2494.
Probably got it.
And now, if Paul's not here, which one should we go to next? All right, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3172. Christine?
It's yours.
This is yours.
It's mine, but.
In effect. Oh, good. Okay. Great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3172 would direct the Department of Revenue to suspend collection of unpaid tax from an elderly taxpayer if certain conditions exist. In OLIS, you have a -1 amendment. The amendment actually makes some changes to the age of eligibility for this deferral of collections, and it changes it from 65 years old to 62 years old. It also changes the Department of Revenue review process to every 24 months instead of annually, and changes notice requirements if a taxpayer is disqualified from the suspension of collection to require a list of the types of income provided by federal law from assignment or prohibited by federal law from assignment or collection, and clarifies that the Department of Revenue still has the authority to file a lien to collect unpaid tax. Taxpayers who are over age 65 and whose sole source of income is federal Social Security benefits would be eligible.
Very good. So we have Steve Hilger, Mary Hilger. How about Eric Olson? Great. all three. So if you will state your name for the record and then give your testimony. Thank you.
Steve J. Hilbert, Jr. What?
Give your testimony.
Oh, okay. I'm here today on behalf of the tax for seniors. I was audited after I retired when I was 62 due to health reasons. And I keep getting threatening letters and phone calls from the IRS saying it's going to close my bank account and take all my stuff and sell it for the debt owed. And this ain't right. So I bumped into Eric Olson at HALP, and he relieved the pressure I was building on me. Since then, I got COPD, only got 40% of my lungs. And what we make on Social Security, time we pay our bills and stuff, we got less than $200 for food. $200 for two people is not enough to really, you know, have balanced meals. It's better than a dog food aisle, I can tell you that. If there's a way, you know, I'm speaking for all seniors. We can't do it when we've got this Social Security income, and then all of a sudden, why didn't they tell us when I was working? Why didn't they audit then? But wait until you retire, and we went through the downfall of America, you know, and the housing crunch and everything. We lost everything we had. And now I'm trying to come back, and I'm still getting these threatening phone calls and these letters in the mail saying they're taking my bank account and everything else, which Mr. Olson told me that they can't touch my Social Security. So if they can't touch my Social Security, why can't we rewrite the law where I don't have to pay this? They can't send all these threatening stuff to us.
Thank you.
You said IRS. Did you mean the Oregon Department of Revenue?
Huh?
Did you mean the Oregon
Oregon Department of Revenue.
That's where you're getting the letters from.
Yeah, thank you.
Mary, do you want to add to that?
My name is Mary Hilger. I live in Almsville, Oregon, with my husband, Steve, here. He's pretty much touched all the bases that I was going to go over with you in the first place.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Olson.
We may have a telephone testimony in a few minutes, but yes.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman Barnhart, Representative Vents, representatives, my name is Eric Olson. I'm very glad to be here today in support of House Bill 3172. I'm a native Oregonian. I graduated from the University of Oregon Law School in 1978. I have met with thousands of seniors throughout the entire state of Oregon, personally, in every corner of the state, from Coos Bay to Astoria to Seaside to LeGrand, Enterprise, Joseph, Ontario, Lakeside, Lakeview, or Lakeview, Klamath Falls, Bend, the whole state, the Willamette Valley. I'm currently the executive director of a nonprofit law firm. It's called HELPS, Help Eliminate Legal Problems for Seniors and Disabled Persons. What we do is we protect seniors from harassment by debt collectors throughout all the United States. We're centered here in Salem. And we also educate people, seniors and people that work with seniors, on seniors' rights. Statistically, 43% of Oregon seniors over the age of 65 are classified by the Economic Policy Institute as economically vulnerable. They're within 200% of the poverty line, and that's not a lot of money. For a single person, poverty line in Oregon is about $950, and for a couple, it's like $1,328. And so there's nearly over a quarter million Oregonians over the age of 65, according to the last census, would fit into that category as being economically vulnerable. If I talk to these seniors, if I talk to 19 or 49 out of 50, they don't realize that under federal law, their Social Security and their pensions and their retirement is protected from collection. Collectors can't touch it. But they also don't realize that it's protected by federal law from collection by the Oregon Department of Revenue. And a lot of these seniors, for different reasons, either incidents of age, the Great Recession of 2008, illness, disability, death of a spouse, any number of reasons, they find themselves like this sweet couple in poverty owing the state of Oregon money for taxes or other reasons. I've talked to widows in this state that have cut their medicine in half. And I've talked to widows and widowers that lived on $40 a month in groceries. They turn off the heat and cuddle up in a blanket. They don't know what to do. They have nowhere to turn. Because they're poor, they don't have a whole lot of advocates out there speaking for them. Yet the federal law is clear that their Social Security and their pensions and retirement is protected by law, cannot be touched. Now, if we get on the Oregon Department of Revenue's website, and the Oregon Department of Revenue does have an important mandate to collect taxes. But if we get on the website, on their statement of rights, it says, if you owe money to the state, we will garnish your wages, garnish your bank account, we will collect the debt. Nowhere on a statement of rights does it ever mention to our seniors that, by the way, your Social Security is protected, your pension is protected. We cannot touch it. Now, we're talking about seniors in the state that are poor. They don't have a lot of money. They're like this couple. They struggle. So what this bill would do would, it wouldn't mandate, but I think the amendment, it may not have been cleared, it would require the Oregon Department of Revenue that they offer to suspend collection on people that meet this category for old taxes. Now, I've met with, like I said, thousands of people. If there's one group that wants to file their taxes and pay their taxes, it's Oregon seniors. They want to do it. But the problem is when they get poor, it's just they can't do it. And I suspect that the vast majority of Oregon seniors will still choose to pay their taxes. But this law would require that the Oregon Department of Revenue make an offer to these people that they can put on uncollectible status. Now, the IRS has a policy. They can technically collect 15% of Social Security. They rarely do. But the IRS has a longstanding policy of putting people into uncollectible status. They have criteria. The state of Oregon, I've never in my entire practice ever talked to a senior that ever told me that the Oregon Revenue Agent said, by the way, we can't collect from you. Never. Not once. It's just the opposite. In conclusion, I think the state would save a lot of money by passing this bill. A couple reasons. One, the revenue agents could concentrate people that had money. Okay. Second off, is it right to be able to collect money that's protected by law from seniors, so they go without their medicine, go without their food, and they get illness or they have problems, and all kinds of problems crop up. It just doesn't seem to make sense. The state will be honoring and observing the law by the passage of 3172. Our law firm protects seniors from harassing collectors every day, debt collectors. And I just don't know why I should be doing it for the to keep them from the state of Oregon when the law says that you can't touch this money. And so that's what this bill would do. It would simply require the state offer to tell these people, hey, by the way, you don't have to collect this money. When I walked in the door, I noticed an engraving outside. It said, this building will be conducted a quest for righteousness. And then when I walked in further, I looked up there and it said, we will search for righteousness. And that's what this bill does. It's just making what is right. Now, my only regret is I never came to the legislature many years ago about this. As an attorney that helped people with financial problem, I've known about this problem for a long time. And bless the Oregon Department of Revenue's heart. I mean, sometimes you get caught in a rut and you do things and you don't know why you do it. And this is a chance for the Oregon Department of Revenue to get things right. These revenue agents can go home at night. They don't have to worry about shaking down a widow, a 70-year-old widow, for $800 in taxes that they may know in the back of their mind that she's not obligated to pay and she can't afford to pay. It'll just make things right. So for those reasons, I would ask that you strongly consider this passage of this bill. It's very needful for this state, and it affects more than a few people.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Bentz, please, and then Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And As folks can see, I brought this bill in response to Mr. Olson's request that, that we bring such a bill. I've met numerous times, of course, with the Department of Revenue to go over the nature of the bill, and have expressed to the department that obviously supportive of making sure we collect taxes from those that owe them, but on the other hand, we don't want to be violating laws while we do it. So the issue is that balance. It was expressed to me by the department that there is basically a five-step program. They follow, they send the bill, they send a notice and demand, they issue a warrant, they make a phone call and before they issue a garnishment. So the question would be, what could be done that they're not already doing? Because at the end of the day, it dawned on me that the department would still have to ask, because they're not going to just automatically know the facts about people. They're not going to know if this is their only income. Sometimes they won't know until they actually serve the warrant, particularly if people don't respond to the initial four contacts. It was also explained to me that under the new system that's going to be used in sending out these notices, the form will be far less threatening, is probably the right word. For those reasons, it seemed to me that the department has made its case that the process it's following currently is at least, I'm going to call it normal. So the issue would be, under this bill, and this is one of the reasons I'm leaving it up to you to make the case for it, and I'm not, does this bill allow the department to determine who it is that still is in a position to pay? Because they won't know just by osmosis. They have to ask. So it seems like the damage, the difficulty, the overreaching is that which occurs perhaps people haven't responded, and then there's a warrant served or a garnishment more likely on an account without them knowing, the department, because they haven't been responded to previously. So that being the case, how would this bill be necessary if they're already going through these processes?
I can address that. First, the representatives know this, and it's important to know this. When the Oregon Department of Revenue sends out a notice, up to about 3 or 4 years ago, it said big, bold, red letters in huge type, distraint warrant. Now, I don't know about you. If I got a notice that said distraint warrant, I would think, number one, I'm going to be arrested. Okay? Now, the Oregon Department of Revenue changed that and made it a little bit smaller print, but it's still bold, and it says distraint warrant. I get calls every week, multiple times. Am I going to get arrested? Do I need to worry about this? What's going on, Mr. Olson? Even though underneath that distraint warrant says, by the way, this only means that there's a lien on your property. It's not, doesn't mean you're going to be arrested. So, I mean, that scares people, and I think it personally it's wrong. It's not addressed in this bill. I'd love it to get addressed, and we'll take it up. We're trying to take it up with the Oregon Department of Revenue. That language should be changed. It's just a tax lien. It's only common sense. Now, as far as the collectors for the Oregon Department of Revenue, most people, the Oregon Department of Revenue, if most of the collection problems we experience are with the Oregon Department of Revenue agents calling people on the phone and telling them they need to pay the debt. And it's a very simple matter for the Oregon Department of Revenue agent, like it is for the IRS, to simply say, what is your income? It's Social Security. And I get $160 and a little pension from wherever. Then they say, oh, by the way, then we can, do you realize your income is protected by law? And we can ask a couple questions here, and we can get you on an uncollectible status with the state, just like the Oregon Department, just like the IRS does. It'd be pretty simple for them to do that. Representative Bentz, they haven't done it to date. That's not their procedure. They don't do it. It would be maybe through rulemaking, it'd be very simple for the state in their notices to say, people, you know, if your income is only Social Security or a pension or disability or VA benefits, contact us, maybe a certain department within the Oregon Department of Revenue, like the IRS has. They have a tax advocacy group that helps people get on uncollectible status, and we'll talk about putting you on uncollectible status. It's going to save the state money if they can take these people that are broke and can't afford it and stop collecting on them. And I don't think the way it's working to date has been effective that day. I just talked to too many people with the problems.
Thank you. Representative Benz?
Well, the follow-up was simply for you to define they're not doing it. What did you mean by they're not the it that you're asserting they're not doing?
They're not advising people when they find out that their income is Social Security or pension, that the income is protected by law. They simply don't do it. They say, well, you're going to need to make an arrangement. I think the telephone testimony you're going to hear, a lady will go into great detail about what a revenue agent did last fall. I don't want to dish the Oregon Department of Revenue. They're doing their job. I think the legislature can give them, this bill can give them clarification and give them an out so they don't have to go after these people that are poor and can't afford to pay it. And legally, their income is protected. It's the law.
Thank you. Representative Smith-Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this. Thank you both for coming and speaking before us. This is the kind of example we need to hear to help us learn about this. So I have a couple questions. So can I clarify that indeed this would put into state law, state tax regulation, what already is in IRS regulation, which is, so right now under Oregon statute, if you only have Social Security, you cannot be collected at the federal level, and this would put that same federal regulation at the state level. Is that correct? My first question.
Okay, answer it this way. The federal law mandates what the state could do. The Oregon Department of Revenue knows that they cannot garnish someone's Social Security. That's why this couple said when they got a hold of us, I told them you don't have to worry about it. But the Oregon Department of Revenue does not advise people of this. It's like a driver's manual. It's like premium driver's manual for all of us and saying, here's your driver's manual. You got to know the law. But when we go out on the street, on the road, there's no stop signs. There's no traffic lights. There's no speed limit. There's nothing telling us. We have to learn. We have to kind of like find out for ourselves what the speed is in this particular place. And that's what it is today, is if the person doesn't tell the agent, oh, by the way, you know, affirmatively, and these older people think they simply can't do that. They don't know. So it would mandate that the Oregon Department of Revenue affirmatively take some action on people that are, and if they find out their income is Social Security, pension, retirement is, that they say, hey, we offer to suspend the taxes. And the state can still file a lien if they've got a piece of real property and collect on it when the house gets sold. If they have other assets, they can go after them. I think the amendments would suggest that we tie in the personal property exemptions to what the personal property exemptions in Oregon are for bankruptcy. As a practical matter, the Oregon Department of Revenue never goes after a person's personal property anyway. I never see it. And there might be a few cases where someone has some horrendous gun collection and they find out about it, but So it will be possible to still collect taxes from people that have assets under this law. An offer to suspend only. It would not mandate the suspension, because most of these people will want to pay their taxes. I'm talking about the poor couple that's living off of $200 a month for their food and their excess income.
Okay. And it sounds like this is probably something that I will perhaps take up with the sponsor, my good colleague, Representative Benz. I'm just trying to get to, is there, because this is already policy, is there indeed a need for us to legislate this versus dealing with it administratively? I mean, that is what.
And we will hear from the department later, and you can ask them that question.
Great. Yeah. Thank you.
That would be Representative Whitsitt, please.
Do you know what the average owed would be? You talked about lots of.
I don't know if there's an average. I spoke to a lady a couple weeks ago back in Maine or Massachusetts that was an Oregon resident. She was getting notices all the time because she owed $127 to the Oregon Department of Revenue. You'll hear from next time, who lost all her retirement, lives only on Social Security, I think owed $10,000 in taxes. So it's all over the map. It doesn't matter. I mean, in my experience, it doesn't matter how much they owe. The state simply, as their statement of rights says, if you owe, we will collect.
Just a follow-up. So is it all forms of taxes, income tax and property tax, or primarily one or the other?
We're talking about income taxes here. This bill talks about income taxes, but technically, in property taxes, it's a different animal. It's not part of this. We're talking about income taxes. And I guess the one thing I want to reemphasize is that this income we're talking about, that we're telling Oregon Department of Revenue, is protected by federal law. It's protected.
Right. Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? We do have a lady who would like to testify by phone, and Edward's going to call her and see if we can get her on the line, and so we'll hear from her that way. My understanding is that she has been essentially told by her doctor she's not to travel today, so that's why we're doing it this way.
While you're making that call, I want to make a point. Last week, we had over 25 people here, and I told them to stay home because a lot of them came from as far as Brookings.
Right.
And it costs money for these old people to come here.
Sure.
So I just want the representative to know that there's a lot of people interested in this bill.
All right. Well, Mr. Olson, I think you've made the point quite well.
Hello?
Hi, Lois.
Yes, this is Lois.
Hi, you're here with the House Revenue Committee.
Lois, this is Representative Barnhart. I'm the chair of the House Revenue Committee, and you're here on the phone with a significant audience and a bunch of committee members, and we understand that you wanted to testify on the bill that we're considering today, which would suspend collection of unpaid taxes under some circumstances involving older folks. If that's right, we would love to hear your testimony, starting with your name.
That is correct, and thank you so very much for allowing me to testify over the telephone. I broke my ankle.
So if you'd...
My name is Lois Hughes, and I live in Portland, Oregon. And I just wanted to start with telling you a little bit about myself. I'll be 70 years old later this month. I'm retired, and I depend 100% on my Social Security income. In other words, I live just right at the poverty level and really struggle to make ends meet with the cost of everything increasing so much. Less than 10 years ago, I couldn't imagine in my wildest dreams that this would happen to me. I'm proud of my background and long work history. I've been working since I was 15 years old and still managed to graduate valedictorian on the honor roll from my high school. I've never taken time off work except for the short periods of time to have my three children, which I raised on my own. I've worked myself up through the job market, and for the last 17 years of my career, I worked at Tektronix, and it's very well paid, respected. I traveled and implemented globally software for Tektronix. I was in good shape for my retirement. I participated in the 401k. And when the bottom fell out of the economy, my retirement investment just disappeared. That was the first devastating blow. Then I was told, I just got back from Japan on Saturday, and on Monday morning I got laid off from work. Tektronix had laid off 250 managers, including myself. I was 64, and being in the midst of that recession, I found it very difficult to find another job, especially at my age. And I received 3 months severance, and when that 3 months severance ran out, I decided I, instead of trying to go on unemployment and looking for a job, I would go with my retirement. So I implemented my Social Security retirement, and unfortunately, Social Security just wasn't enough to cover my expenses. Remember that I came from a six-figure income, and the expenses, of course, to match that. I had a mortgage on a home, my car payment, and it didn't take very long to fall behind, so I had no choice but to file for a bankruptcy. I opted to go with Chapter 13 because that allows you to set up a payment plan. I wanted to pay everybody. I didn't want to just flake off and not do that. And my bankruptcy over it, Chapter 13 goes over a five-year period, as you know. And so it increased in payments as we went along, and it got up to $900 a month. So I finally, since I couldn't get a full-time position, I opted to go with a contract position. I worked for Nike for 6 months, and then I contracted with Xerox for another 6 months. What I didn't know at the time is if you exceed the income level threshold, meaning that I owed taxes on my entire Social Security income that I had received for the time period. So by the time that I contacted the IRS and the Oregon Department of Revenue, I no longer had a job. I didn't wait for them to come after me, so the IRS told me right away, that was pretty easy. They said I had to fill out these forms, I had to give them some detailed information on what my status was, and they granted me uncollectible status. Working with the Oregon Department of Revenue really was not that easy. It was difficult. I reached out to them to make arrangements for a payment plan or find out about qualifying for uncollectible status. Since I had to drop my bankruptcy, I could not afford the $900 a month payments anymore. I didn't dare work because I would go over the threshold and end up owing huge amounts of taxes. So I told them that the IRS had put me on uncollectible status, and I asked if it was possible with the state, and he said no. So I filled out the documents he wanted. I had to send in my budget, my monthly budget. He wanted 3 months bank statements. I had to go through every line on my bank statement and tell him what every item was for 3 months. I got that back to him. Next time we talked, he asked me if I had a car. I said, yes, I had a car, an older car. And he suggested that I sell that to pay my debt. And I said, I have to go to the doctor. That is my only transportation. I can't sell my car. And he said, well, you need to think about that. Do you have other assets? You need to start selling assets to pay this debt. And I said, you know, I can pay you $25 a month out of my Social Security, but that's all. And he never once told me that that Social Security income was exempt. So I just got to my breaking point, and I don't cry very often, but that scared me, and I didn't know what else to do. I just didn't know what else to do. So I contacted the HELPS attorney, and you've heard from Eric Olson earlier, and he explained immediately to me that they couldn't garnish my Social Security income. As I told him, I said, do I have to close my bank account? Do I have to keep my money under my pillow? And he said, no, that they couldn't touch the Social Security income. And they have known since I first filled out my paperwork that Social Security was my only income. So I really don't want to see this happen to other people. Other people, we just can't be afraid to answer the telephone. We can't be afraid that somebody's going to take all of our money. We don't have that much to start with. So that's why I'm asking you to support House Bill 3172. And I know that paying my fair share is the right thing to do. I did it for 50 years. I just don't have the income right now to do it anymore. So thank you very, very much for your time, and I would be more than happy to entertain any questions, and I thank you again for allowing me to testify over the telephone.
Well, thank you, Ms. Hughes, and we appreciate your testimony. Are any members of the committee have questions for her? Representative Smith-Warner, please.
Thank you. Thank you so much for calling in. Just one quick question. So this may be obvious, but so your case was then resolved favorably for you?
Not yet, no. They quit calling me and hounding me as soon as I contacted the HELPS organization, but I have never received any outcome. I have not received anything that that tells me what is happening. I have no clue what they're doing right now.
And when was your last contact?
Last fall.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Hughes. We appreciate your testimony, and if that's okay, we are going to hang up and go on to our next witness.
Okay. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you very much.
Go sit back
there. We have left on our list John Mullen and Deanna Mack, probably with different positions, I suspect. Mr. Mullen, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. The Oregon Law Center, as you're aware, works on behalf of Oregon's low-income communities. The people you see here in the building, myself and Sybil Hubb, are the ones that do the lobbying and policy work for the Oregon Law Center. But we, in fact, through our legal aid community, have offices all around the state. In the main, we work with people at 125% of the federal poverty level or less. As far as this particular bill is concerned, I have a call out to our network to gather some information about what our experiences have been with people in this particular set of circumstances. So I spoke previously, right before committee, with Representative Bentz, and I would just say to the committee, if this issue does get worked further, we're happy to provide whatever information we can that may be of assistance in making a decision on this bill.
Thank you very, very much. Any questions for Mr. Mullen? Thank you. Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And I'm just here to answer questions you have about our collection process, and I prepared a quick overview for you of what our collections process is and the tools that we already have on the in law now, and some of what our program staff are able to do. If you want me to go over that for you to help you understand, I think I need to do slideshow.
Yes.
Okay. There we go. I used to drive in a PowerPoint up here. So the first slide, it just talks about what I think Representative Vince kind of alluded to, is one of the things that we do. We first send a taxpayer a bill. The very first thing we do is, and it's usually in the form of some sort of self-assessment or deficiency assessment. And then we send about 35 days later a demand for payment that says you can ask for a payment plan. You can, and I've actually attached copies of those at the end. It's at this point, it's lawfully owed debt, and we have an obligation to ask for payment, and so we do ask for payment. We ask them to contact us, and then about 35 days later, we actually send a notice, the distraint warrant, and you may know it's recorded sometimes in the county if there's real property. It is issued even if the debtor is in a payment plan to secure the state's rights. And it does say at the top, like they said, distraint warrant. It is unfortunate. That is what the statutes call it. You may remember, Representative Barnhart, a few years ago, you had a bill that actually changed the warrant so that it doesn't look as quite as intimidating. It did used to say writ of execution at the bottom and said, we will have the sheriff show up and seize your property. And you did have that removed. It was unnecessary. Necessary in the statute, so we did change that. So the warrant, frankly, is still intimidating, but it is it's much nicer than it once was, thanks to your bill. We do have statutory tools currently in the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. There's an option for them to do payment plan. We also have settlement offers where taxpayer who has means to pay and wants to pay at least some of their debt, we go through a financial statement process, and we can cancel their debt if they stay in compliance after 3 years. We also have a write-off process where it goes into a holding bucket, for lack of a better term, if there's no assets. And then we also consider debt for cancellation. There's active collections that we deal with. A payment plan is when the debtor contacts us And for personal income tax debt, within if they can pay it off within 12 months, we pretty much allow them to do whatever they want, as long as it's granted automatically, basically. If they pay it off within, if they think they can pay it off within 12 to 18 months, then we have the agent grant that. We have them think creatively. We ask them in some of our manuals, the instructions, I think it says think creatively. What can the taxpayer do? What's their financial situation? And then they have their manager review it. If it's more than 18 months for personal income tax, then we have to have them complete a financial statement, which does sound like, I think it was Ms. Hughes said she completed, and then a manager has to approve it. It does require bank statements to go along with that. For a payment plan. So settlement offer, we help to resolve taxpayer debt when there's no debt that's being appealed. They all agree that the debt is owed. All their tax returns are filed. They've not done an offer in the past, and they have to make a 5% down payment. They can't be in bankruptcy. There's certain rules, but we offer them to reduce the amount that they owe based on the conditions, their financial conditions. And then that just completely abates it. It completely goes away. If the conditions are met. Now, the write-off is where we, that's a statutory requirement in the financial statutes in Chapter 293 that allows agencies to move an accounts receivable item into a holding bucket, for lack of a better word. If there's no payment, no activity on the account in the last 3 years, we move it out of our AR and move it into what we call write-off. Now, if there's something else that triggers write-off, for example, triggers an asset potential, maybe a sale or something like that, then we can reinstate it from write-off and collect the amount that's owed. If more than 7 years pass, the debt will be canceled. And that's because the cancellation rules says that the debt has to be at least 7 years old, the cancellation statutes. And this is going to be a little bit more automated with our new system in Gentax. My understanding is that once an account goes into write-off after the three-year mark and it hits that seven-year mark of no activity, then it'll just automatically be canceled out of our AR. And cancellation is different than write-off, and the debt is forever extinguished. So we can't, if there's some asset that can be collected from, we cannot collect, we can't reinstate it, we can't collect it. It's just forever gone. So that is where the tax has been delinquent for seven or more years. All reasonable efforts have been made to collect. Taxpayer can't be collected or is deceased, or the tax is wholly uncollectible. And that is the component where we consider folks in the situation that is in this bill for cancellation. We have instructions in our staff instructions that tell them for temporarily uncollectible status, which we will put them in hold status for 6 months at a time if they meet certain criteria. And one of them is if the taxpayer is at poverty level on public assistance, workers' compensation, or receives only Social Security payments. Or, you know, unemployment, that kind of thing. Now, what we do is we put them on hold. Like, for example, the most common scenario is where a taxpayer becomes unemployed and they're collecting unemployment benefits. And so we'll ask the agent to set them on hold for 6 months and check back in, because the idea is that eventually they'll get a job and they'll be able to pay us again. So we don't exactly cancel that in that scenario, but we will put them on hold. But if the taxpayer works with us and informs us and tells us that they have these things, these kinds of income, then we do consider them for cancellation under your current statutes. Chapter 305, 155 allows us to cancel it. 293, 240 allows us to do this. There are several ways, and Oregon law in Chapter 18 for all agencies exempts certain income from garnishment, just like federal law. Or as Chapter 18, I think it's, I want to say 345, somewhere around there. Don't quote me on that. But it does list what is exempt from garnishment in Oregon. So we don't know necessarily before we go into garnishment mode that the debt is exempt from garnishment, and that's when we get into active collections. And usually that happens when a taxpayer breaks a payment plan that they've established, or they just don't engage with us, or they break a payment plan and don't engage with us. It could be both of those things. Now, we do get to the point where we have to issue a notice of garnishment when we haven't engaged, when the taxpayer hasn't engaged with us or the debtor. And the notice of garnishment does act to garnish 100% of their assets that are in control, the possession, custody, and control of the garnishee. Wages have a 75% exemption, so we can only take 25% of that, but we could take the entire amount of the bank garnishment, whatever's in their bank account. You did pass some legislation in 2009, Senate Bill 731, that allowed banks and financial institutions, credit unions, to, if they know that the income in the bank account is exempt from garnishment, such as Social Security direct deposits, other types of income like that, pension amounts, they don't send it to us. They instead say, sorry, this income was exempt from garnishment, and so it's not even sent to us. In the event that the financial institution cannot tell that it was exempt from garnishment, then you've got laws in Chapter 18 that allows the debtor to challenge the garnishment and say that the amount you took was exempt from garnishment, and it's all in those instructions as well, and we have to give that money back to them fairly quickly. If we don't respond, I think within 14 days, we automatically have to give it back to them without consideration for whether it was exempt or not. So we do have a lot of tools on the books now. I do agree that we could do a better job of educating them with our taxpayer bill of rights, and I've offered to Mr. Olson and his group of people to update that language. It's a document that's online, and in every notice that we send, we link taxpayers to the website where that document can be found. And we're happy to put information in that says that the Social Security and retirement and veterans benefits is exempt from garnishment. We've shared that in our meetings with them. But I wanted to give you some examples of our notices and the complaint that we get a lot about them. If you can see here, this is a notice of assessment in our old system. It is not very readable. It's very, it's just not a very nice notice. And in our new system, it's still not very easy to see on the screen here, but it is a nicer font. It's clearer to read. It's not quite as intimidating. At some level, our notices do have to have some official look to them. They can't be really too very friendly because we are trying to collect a debt at some level. So this is an example of our notice in demand for payment. And it, again, was pretty intimidating. It had a payment coupon at the top. And our new system in Gentax, this is what it looks like now. I think I went to the wrong slide. It's still a lot of information, but it's just not as intimidating as it once was. This is the warrant. Again, it does say distraint warrant on it. That is legally what they are. And I understand the confusion around what a warrant is. A warrant in the government world is this, and several agencies have the authority to issue them. But we did take out at the bottom, if you recall, the writ of execution language and the threat with sending the sheriff out down here at the bottom several years ago, or maybe not even several years ago. It might have been just a couple of years ago. And then part of the new system that we haven't had before that we have now is a statement of account. And we'll be able to send people periodic billings with payment coupons to let them know an additional source of being able to pay. So with that, that's just our collections overview and the tools and statutory authorities that you already have us able to do. Many of these notices are required by statute to send. In fact, a lot of them are required by statute to send, except maybe the statement of account. With that, if you have any questions about our collections process.
I think there are probably several. Please, Representative Whitson, go ahead.
I was wondering if it would be beneficial for banks to have certain marked or flagged accounts, because Social Security has to be direct deposited now for everybody who receives it. So maybe the answer lies in something like that with a special account. And so it would be really easy much easier for you to see, or the bank to see, and contact you about it if the account only receives Social Security.
Representative Barnhart and Representative Whitsitt, right now I let the banks speak to that, but I do know that this body passed in 2009 a bill that allowed banks to not send that money to us in the event that they could identify that it was exempt from garnishment. And it does, you're right, it is direct deposited now, so they can see on the bank statements and in their transactions very clearly, and it has cut down on the number of garnishment challenges that we have received over the years. It was a very helpful piece of legislation, I think, for everybody.
Thank you.
Other questions? Do you know if private debt collectors are required to let people know that they can't execute against Social Security and other payments of that kind that are exempt from execution?
Mr. Chair, I do not believe that they have the same, that is a requirement. We all follow the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. I know they're all exempt. It's exempt from garnishment for them as well, but I don't know if they're required to notify them. I could find out for you.
Now, nobody actually said this, but the clear implication from the testimony we've heard so far from the people who have been affected by the debt collection practices of the department are that the people who are trying to collect the money are trying to get people to send them money, which they know they can't execute against because it's exempt. Is that an accurate inference on my part?
Mr. Chair, I do hear where you're hearing that and what's going on here. I don't know that that is the norm, but agents are tasked to collect the tax that's owed. We have a huge AR balance. We are not trying to collect from people who are insolvent or in poverty level, that kind of thing. We do need to consider them for cancellation and if the tax is wholly uncollectible. There is probably an education component. We have a lot of new collectors in the department where we could do a better job perhaps of making sure they understand that they need to that this is exempt income. It's not just you can't garnish it, but you should talk to them about maybe cancellation. A lot of these people want to pay us anyway, and so we offer them very, very small payment plans to try and help collect. Even though they have exempt income, we still try and work with them to set up payment plans to make those payments. So there, I think there's multiple.
Okay, so let me ask the next question.
Okay.
The people who are charged with making these collections, under circumstances in which the assets are exempt from execution, do they warn people, I can't collect anything from you because your assets are exempt from execution, but I sure would like it if you'd send me $25?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that they say it exactly like that, but I do think that they tell them that they can't garnish. I know I've heard agents tell them that. I don't know if that's a standard practice, but they do say that they can't go to enforced collections, which is the garnishment stage, but I don't know if it's routine. But we could certainly train people on that to make sure that they're educating their taxpayers on that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith-Warner.
I think in follow-up to that and to repeat what I had asked the earlier panel is indeed, do you as a department believe that this is an issue that can be dealt with administratively, or do you see the value in having this be legislated?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Smith-Warner, I think you've given us the tools we need to be able to take care of these situations. We've already have legislative authority to cancel debt if it's wholly uncollectible. We can put them in write-off status. We, as a matter of policy, already put them in hold status if we know that there's an event that's beyond their control, such as someone who loses their job and needs to just find employment and only has unemployment income. We have the tools I think you need. We're perfectly happy to update our Taxpayer Bill of Rights to show the information that that this is exempt from garnishment. I don't know if they go there. I mean, I know that we provided in our notices, we link them to it. We'll mail it to them if they want. It's part of our one of our PAPs that we our policy and procedures that we have for staff to use. It's dated back to 2006, can be updated. It's for wholly uncollectible. Temporarily uncollectible status. We do put people in hold status regularly. I think we have the tools we need to do what we need to do, if that answers your question.
Thank you.
It sounds to me as though one of the things you've not quite said, but maybe you did, I'm not sure, is that Your agent who's attempting to make a collection may very well know that the assets that at least are readily available are not subject to execution. And yet, at the same time, they're quite willing to accept a payment from a person whose assets are wholly protected, and that they may even ask for that payment. Have I understood that correctly?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. We do ask for payment.
Would it be useful for the department to have permission from the legislature to not make that attempt at collection under those circumstances?
would it be useful? I'd have to.
I guess what I'm really asking is, you've said several times, mm-hmm. either both on the your presentation mm-hmm. there and also orally that your job is to collect the money, and of course that's absolutely correct. On the other hand, we have other considerations besides simply collecting money, mm-hmm. and does the department need permission to under circumstances in which the assets are wholly exempt from execution to not ask for a collection for a payment?
Mr. Chair, we do not need permission for that. We already have authority to analyze the account, to remove it from collections. If the taxpayer informs us that their only assets are assets that we cannot collect.
But you also said that if the taxpayer says, I'd like to send you $25, you're willing to accept that.
We do. We absolutely
and
will.
Of course, what we've heard from some of the witnesses is that people, especially Mr. Olson, is that mm-hmm. many times people will make a payment even though they don't have the money, and it ends up causing them to have difficulties in other aspects of their life. I'm trying to figure out, is there a way mm-hmm. to get from where we are today, where those kinds of payments get made, to a place where they won't get made mm-hmm. because you can't force it a payment, and it really is not wise for the person to make that payment mm-hmm. given the rest of the circumstances of their lives. Mm-hmm. Thoughts on that topic?
Mr. Chair, I think we do already have the ability to put people into a temporarily uncollectible status and not make them have to make that choice of whether they need to buy prescription or whatever. We have the means to tell. They do have to show us a bank statement, and it does sound unfortunate in Ms. Hughes' case that someone went line by line through there, but we can usually identify what information is in the account. It's only if we can't see that it's there, and then we can put them in hold status. I think it's just a matter of potentially educating a little bit more what our staff and the options that are available to them. We can remove them and cancel it in wholly if they are in these people's situations. I'd be interested to know if we have canceled the debt on these people. I don't know. Now that I know who they are, but I really believe that we do have the authority that we need to be able to deal with these situations, and I feel that they are unfortunate. They do sound unfortunate to me, but I would encourage them to even work with me directly, and I'd be happy to interface with our collection staff to deal with these accounts. And again, we're happy to put anything in the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. If you'd like us to inform taxpayers, we absolutely would do that.
Thank you. Any other questions? I think it would be extremely useful if we were to hear from Mr. Olson or other people next year that he's not getting these calls anymore from people who are exempt and who he has to tell that, no, you don't have to pay because the assets you have are exempt. I don't know how to get there from here, but it sure would be nice if the department figured that out.
Duly noted, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill. Is it 3172? Yes. Is that the one I'm closing? Mm-hmm. Yeah, 3172. Is Representative Holvey available? Do we know?
There he is.
Oh, he's here. He's sitting in the corner. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill.
He's being punished.
3481.
Go sit in the corner.
3481. Are you on that one?
Sure.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3481 would impose a new severance tax of $20 per 1,000 board feet on the harvest of timber from forest lands in Oregon. And this would be to fund, among other things, the income tax credit for milling of logs in Oregon. The milling would have to be less than 12 inches in length and be done in Oregon. The revenues also would go to several other sources, and these include the $3 per 1,000 board feet to the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, and this is fire protection. Another $3 per 1,000 board feet to the Residential Solid Fuel Heating and Air Quality Improvements Fund.
$3 per thousand board feet to the Watershed Conservation Grant Fund, and $3 per thousand board feet, or the cost of the credit, whichever is less, would go to the general fund in order to pay for the biomass production tax credit. And so if the production tax, if that credit is greater than $3 per thousand board feet, then the amount that would be paid would be $3 per thousand board feet. And if it were less, the cost of that credit would be paid for to the general fund from this. And the final, or the money from the severance tax would also go to the general fund, and this is to pay for the tax credit provided for in this measure, which is the credit for milling of logs in Oregon. That credit would be $3 per thousand board feet, and the remaining money after all of these these amounts are paid would go to the counties, and would be allocated to the counties in proportion to the amount of harvest that each county has. And so this would be a new harvest tax on timber harvested in the state. Currently, the existing forest products harvest taxes total $3.53 per thousand board feet.
Thank you. Representative Holby.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about House Bill 3481 and an ongoing discussion of taxes in our state. And when we look at taxes and all the needs that we have, it comes to mind we have some real looming issues. And I've looked at the harvest tax, and this particular bill is a severance tax, a little bit different, goes into a different fund. I think the committee administrator sort of described the different programs that these monies could go to. As proposed in this bill, I think she described them accurately. They go to help fight forest fires. They go to help pay for the biomass tax credit. They help for the Heat Smart program, and I'm sure I'm forgetting a couple, but the remainder of the monies would then go to essentially the ONC counties or the counties based on their harvest to help them with some of their expenses. When you look at what the forest industry has put into this state, they put a lot of jobs over time, and that's one of the main pieces that made me start thinking about this bill when I would visit Longview or Coos Bay and see millions of board feet of logs going out every year to Asia, raw logs. And at the same time, we're complaining that we have a shortage of timber for mills. And so it just occurred to me that, there's something not right here. And we all know that some of our federal free trade acts are not always exactly fair, but thought this mechanism might enhance our ability to have some jobs here in Oregon milling the timber that we grow instead of shipping it to Asia and then importing our lumber from Canada. A little more than a year ago, several of us legislators got a letter from Steve Zika, I believe, from Hampton Lumber Mills, describing this issue and really, lamenting that we have all this, most of our harvest is from private timber, and it's been, relatively stable over the last 4 years or so, and a good share of that private timber is being exported as logs to overseas. So that started me thinking about, the needs for Oregon and what we could do to change that dynamic. And so that's what started this bill. Didn't get much traction. You may remember a similar version of it last year. I will say this bill's scalable. If the $20 isn't the right figure, I'm working on another amendment to this bill currently. willing to look at others. You know, the needs for some of these other programs are also, you know, a negotiable item I think this committee could entertain as well. When I also consider the state of Oregon and its forest and the forest health that we have and the climate change issues that we have and the forest fires that we have is really putting a big burden on the state of Oregon. We are now looking at paying probably $30 million more than we did last year for forest fires. Due to the, you know, the a little bit of a tweak in the formula of who pays how much for forest fires, and then with Lloyd's of London changing our insurance policy, leaving the state of Oregon with the potential of having to pay $30 million more. So it kind of begs the question of how are we going to do that? Where are we going to come up with the money? A lot of people think we just have this money floating around the general fund. And we're going to have to start saving some in the general fund to be able to put out forest fires in the future, or we're going to have to take it out of K-12 or shut down some prisons and let people out of jail and shut down a couple prisons to come up with the money to fight forest fires in the state. I don't know where else you will get the money. And so if it is an interest of us policy-wise to put out forest fires in the future, and also not to continue to fund education, we need to really seriously think about a new revenue source to fight fires, if nothing else. I'd be happy to see this whole tax just go to fighting fires if that were the will of the committee, you know, because it's such a dire need. I seriously think that after this session, the state's really going to be in trouble of how we're going to put out forest fires in the future. We're going to have to make a policy decision on whether we want to close prisons or fight forest fires. And, you know, I'm not really, you know, excited about that decision, that political decision, but I believe that it is probably the truth, that we will be facing those policy decisions. And I would, you know, really not like to be on that particular vote, voting to close prisons or to cut schools or to stop fighting forest fires, because I believe we're really faced with that choice. As again, I'm you know, looking at this bill, I think it most of the uses that I've put into this bill do relate to the forest industry in one fashion or another, and complement some of the forest practices that we're faced with, whether it's dealing with watersheds or, you know, the biomass tax credit, the Heat Smart program. Even I was hoping that we could, you know, have a rebate program for buying pellets. I think we've talked in another committee about some of those issues, and, you know, maybe that'll come to fruition, but we have to have a funding source to make that happen. And certainly that's it. I have been entertaining an idea of, you know, not making this tax effective for the first 10,000 or so board feet that an owner would harvest. You know, so, you know, the really small woodland owner can, you know, harvest a little bit of timber without having to pay this. But I commend this bill to you. I will continue to work on this subject matter, because I think the needs expressed in this bill are really vital. And I think if you looked at the balance sheet of Weyerhaeuser, for example, this morning, and you will look at, you know, their return on investment of over close to 500% over the last 5 years. You know, I'm wondering if we can also get that kind of increase in our forest fire fund, you know, in relationship. And so I commend this bill to you. I know my friends in the forestry industry probably are not too excited about this again, but I think it is a discussion we have to have. I think it's a discussion that the state has an interest in, because otherwise it's the taxpayer that's flipping the bill for all these needs, and we're going to have to choose between these needs in the near future. So I'd be happy to answer any questions about the bill if you have any, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Questions for Representative Fulvey?
Question?
Yes, Representative Leininger.
Thank you. Thanks for bringing this. It's good to hear your perspective. Do you have a sense? I'm reading that the current tax level is $3.53 approximately per 1,000 board feet. How does that compare? And this would be a significant increase, but I'm curious if you know how the current tax level compares to the tax level in other states. Do you have any idea about that?
It's very difficult to figure that out. Our tax structure on the timber industry is very complicated with, some of the property tax, replacement taxes, the harvest tax and all of that. And then looking at the state of Washington, for example, who has a sales tax, I would commend that effort to Legislative Revenue Office to give you a good answer on that to compare to other states. I think that would be something essential that would have to be looked at, if we're going to, compare us and our competitive taxes to Washington or British Columbia or, other of the 20. Big lumber produced California, other of the lumber producing areas. It does raise flags, of this. But at the same time, it seems to me that our tax structure is such that it seems to be a better idea to ship our logs to Asia. And I don't really, that was the main purpose of this bill, was to try to change that dynamic, just as I think Hampton Lumber Mills expressed in their letter, which I could provide a copy of that to.
That would be great. That would be wonderful if we could put it in the record.
Yeah, well, it came last year, or in 2013, actually, the end of 2013, to several legislators. And I think it expresses the same sentiment. I'm not saying that he supports this bill by any stretch of the imagination. Wouldn't speak for him in that respect. But I think we're trying to solve the same issue. And I just don't see a way for us to solve this issue with the general fund. And, I when I look at the tax input from, the largest timber owners in this state, which are all multinational corporations, nothing against them, and they do provide jobs. I think that we need to look at equity in this system as well. So,
thank you. I will simply note that another bill that was supposed to be up today, which we're not going to get to, House Bill 3020, does do the study that you're proposing. And answer Representative Leininger's question. Other questions for Representative Holby? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question, I guess. In our neck of the woods, we look at timber as a fabulous renewable resource. This country was created to grow trees, and it does it really, really well. But I guess in our quest for revenue and new sources of income to fund programs, why single out just timber? I mean, we export a lot of things. My neighborhood, we grow cherries, pears, apples, a lot of stuff. But so I guess why go after the timber industry, or should we look at some more comprehensive means to direct greater fees at other exports, if you will, who pay their fair share?
Yeah, I that's a fair question. I suppose, when I look at timber, I'm looking at a tax that comes from timber that serves timber. And so that's the way I'm looking at this. As far as the agriculture community, they export usually a more finished product, or at least a product that's ready for market in some sense. And I don't see, I visually see all the logs at our ports, and I see those as jobs going out of state. And I see the return on those logs really not, I question how much benefit the state of Oregon is really getting from those logs. And I look at our ONC counties, who are struggling to maintain roads or to even have public safety, which also serves many of those rural areas that these timberlands exist in. And I see these forest fires as being, really a huge problem. And it affects private timberlands, which are of interest to all of us. But, we're helping flip the bill to fight those forest fires. And, I think there isn't enough equity in this tax structure as it currently exists. And so I guess to a short answer is that's why. It's kind of a combination of different things in this bill, and I see many of the uses of this tax, these dollars as laid out, as benefiting the industry and benefiting more jobs in this industry.
Time tomorrow for that bill. Okay. Other questions? Thank you, Representative Whitsitt. I would note that I have two people who've traveled more than 100 miles to testify today, and I'd like to get to them. We only have a few minutes. If it's an important question, go ahead and ask it.
I was just wondering if you know, because I don't, what the average cost statewide to harvest 1,000 board feet of lumber is. I mean, what are we looking at when we talk about a $20 tax?
Right, right.
Yeah. Getting it to the mill.
Yeah, and I think, and that's why I said this is scalable, because I really don't have, you know, it's hard to get to those figures that are not really forthcoming from the industry. As far as the cost, you can certainly look up the price of timber, you know, per 1,000 board feet, and I'm sure there's people behind me that could probably answer that more accurately. It's, you know, it fluctuates from $300 to $400 to $500, you know, something like that. So,
thank you, Representative. We appreciate it. I have two people who've come more than 100, who said they've come more than 100 miles to testify today, and I want to hear from them before we run out of time. And that's Link. Is it Cannon?
Mm-hmm.
And
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I asked them to check. Somebody else to check the box. I checked.
Oh, and how about Ralph? Did you come from more than 100 miles? That's what I thought. That's what I thought.
He's the guy who checked my box.
I see. All right. All right. Is there anybody who signed up today who can't come back another time to testify? We have 5 minutes. Please come. Yeah, please come forward. Those who will have difficulty coming back another time, please. I've got two. We have 5 minutes. We'll get as much of your testimony in as we can. And we'll reopen for the other testimony on another day.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Gilbert Shibley. I live on and manage 420 acres of family forest land in Clackamas County. I am one of 13 owners of those acres. And there are about 140,000 owners of family-sized forest lands in Oregon. I'm opposed to House Bill 3481. It would impose an unfair tax on me and my family to fund state services that are currently funded or that provide no value to my family and me. It looks to me like a bill full of political bargains or strategies, not meaningful coordination of costs to the private side and benefits to the public side. I'll shorten this a little bit. I already pay into that Oregon Forest Protection Fund through property taxes and harvest taxes, and I believe that the current funding mechanisms will provide the Oregon Forest Protection Fund for adequate funding. Why tax me again for the same thing? And by what logic should us forest tree growers be made to pay into the Residential Solid Fuel Heating Fund or the Watershed Conservation Grant Fund? That's distantly related to my business. Responsibly tending a forest land requires a huge effort over a long time that relies on the revenues that we earn from that forest management. We invest, starting in year one, by planting seedlings. We invest for another 50 to 80 years, in my case, before the final harvest. Why would the state need to, or the sponsor of the bill want to, take another $80 to $100 per load of logs away from us when those funds are needed by us to keep the forest going? The forests are good for the whole state. I think this bill does merit your consideration, but I hope you will agree with me that it does not merit going beyond the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Sandra Bishop. My home is in Eugene in Lane County, one of the most heavily forested counties in the state. I'm here today speaking as an individual, as an Oregonian, as a voter, a responsible citizen. I'm here today to ask that you support Representative Holby's bill, Senate Bill 3481, there's nothing new about this tax. This is simply a reinstatement of the timber harvest tax. And I will skip a whole bunch of my first part of the presentation and skip to a little history lesson. In 1997 session, there was a bill introduced to stop collecting the harvest timber tax. It was vetoed by the governor. In 1999, House Bill 3575 passed the legislature, and what that did, in effect, is stop the collection of harvest tax. What it also did is make a bifurcation in the ownership of wooded forest lands. So anyone with 5,000 acres or under still pay taxes. The big guys don't. Really made a distinction there. It was a very interesting bill. It was introduced late in March. It was in House Revenue Committee in 1999. It had three hearings, and then it had four work sessions and a total of 10 amendments before it. Well, I'm not sure where, maybe the amendments were partly on the Senate side as well. Went through Ways and Means, General Government, went through full Ways and Means, then it went to the Senate. There were only three legislators at the time who had the courage to stand up and say no and vote against it. That was Senator Burdick, Senator Corcoran, and Senator Dukes. Everyone else voted for it. And you have to understand the times. The House was controlled by Republicans. The Senate was controlled by Republicans. There was still faith and hope that the timber industry was going to turn the economy around. Didn't happen then. It's not going to happen now. So fast forward to today, just for a little bit of a reality check, the GDP for wood products in 1977 was about 12 or 13%. The GDP today for wood products is 2%. Not putting this tax back is just simply, it's at this point, it's a fairness and equity issue. You've got the small guys paying the tax. The large multinational companies are not paying taxes in Oregon. They pay taxes in California, in Idaho, Washington, all the surrounding states. But Oregon is not getting what's fair and equitable in the state. We need money for education. We need money into the rural counties. And so I'm going to also skip a little bit of my testimony and just conclude by saying that the revenue loss is at least $50 million. It's between $50 and $60 million a year by not having the timber harvest tax. We need to, as Representative Holby spoke quite eloquently, we need to reduce log exports. Oregon needs better forest management with long-term climate crisis adaptation in mind. And we need to protect the riparian areas and the watersheds. We can do that with some of this money. And I am going to take a leap of faith here and propose that this tax should be bumped to $25 per thousand, and it should predominantly be dedicated to the Common School Fund. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel?
Just really quickly.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Shibley, what means do you and other timberland owners have to affect the price that you're paid for the timber that you harvest from your lands?
The income depends on what the best offers are from buyers, and that depends on where they're located and what kind of products I'm selling.
You're relying upon what the market will pay you, is that correct?
Pardon me?
You're relying upon what the market will pay you.
That's
for
right.
You. That was my question. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, both of you. I appreciate it. Colleagues, we're going to hold over the rest of this hearing till tomorrow. For those who can come back, I appreciate your patience. We'll hold the rest of this hearing over till tomorrow. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3481. We will reschedule House Bill 3020 on another date. Thank you very much. And with that, the committee is adjourned.
I had a good meeting with Cliff yesterday, and we decided.